This is the voice of the Islamic Republic of Iran.
This is the voice of the Islamic Republic of Iran's broadcasting. The voice of the Islamic Republic of Iran is broadcast daily via the internet address www.parstoday.com/en. You can also listen to the voice of the Islamic Republic of Iran on Hotbird, Intelsat 902, and Eutelsat satellite, as well as via internet. You can also listen to IRIB English Radio via your mobile phone. Please refer to our website for more details.
Here we enlighten you with ayahs 261 and 262 from the Surah Baqarah, recited by Ali Parhiskar.
A'udhu billahi minash shaytanir rajim. Bismillahirrahmanirrahim. مَثَلُ الَّذِينَ يُنْفِقُونَ أَمْوَالَهُمْ فِي سَبِيلِ اللَّهِ كَمَثَلِ حَبَّةٍ أَنْبَتَتْ سَبْعَ سَنَابِلَ كَمَثَلِ حَبَّةٍ أَنْبَتَتْ سبع سنابل في كل سنبلة مئة حبة والله يضاعف لمن يشاء والله واسع عليم مثل الذين ينفقون أموالهم في سبيل الله كمثل حبة أنبتت سبع سنابل كمثل حبة أنبتت سبع سنابل في كل سنبلة مئة حبة والله يضاعف لمن يشاء والله واسع عليم الذين ينفقون أموالهم في سبيل الله ثم لا يتبعون ما أنفقوا منا ولا أذى ثم لا يتبعون ما أنفقوا منا ولا أذى لهم أجرهم عند ربهم ولا خوف عليهم ولا هم يحزنون صدق الله العلي العظيم.
In the name of God, the most gracious, the most compassionate. The parable of those who spend their property in the way of Allah is as the parable of the grain growing 7 years, with 100 grains in every ear. And Allah multiplies for whom He pleases, and Allah is ample giving, knowing. As for those who spend their property in the way of Allah, then do not follow what they have spent with reproach or injury, they shall have their reward from their Lord, and they shall have no fear. Nor shall they grieve.
This is IRIB English Radio. Coming up is the news.
At our top stories this hour, South Korea's new president calls Pyongyang's weapons programs a threat to global security and calls for the complete denuclearization of the North. The European Parliament establishes a committee to probe allegations that an Israeli spyware has been used by 50 nations for mass espionage. Also ahead, Russia's chief negotiator in peace talks with Ukraine says negotiations have not stopped and are being held remotely. Thank you for joining us. Our top story this hour, South Korea's new president wants the neighboring North to be completely denuclearized because its weapons pose a threat to global security. The newly inaugurated president, Yoon Suk-yeol, says the South is prepared to resolve this threat through dialogue. According to Yoon, Seoul is willing to offer an audacious plan to help boost the economy of North Korea if Pyongyang moves toward nuclear disarmament. Yoon made the remarks during his inauguration speech in Seoul. Tensions are high on the Korean Peninsula, with the North starting a new push to advance its nuclear and missile program. Pyongyang says its weapons act as a deterrent against U.S.-led threats in the region. Jennifer Chang, our correspondent in Seoul, joins us now to give us further information about that speech. Jennifer, thank you so much for joining us. It's good to talk to you. So tell us more.
Well, the speech today was clearly aimed at getting North Korea to completely and irreversibly denuclearize. And it was attended by a very high-level delegation from the U.S. with the second gentleman, Douglas Emhoff, Vice President Kamala Harris's husband, attending. So this is a major, major piece of news, the fact that South Korea is willing to offer an audacious plan to help North Korea's economy only if it denuclearizes. It clearly intends to continue the massive sanctions levied against it by not only South Korea, but the international community and the United Nations, which is led by the U.S. And of course, the U.S. has its own sanctions on North Korea, which are strangling the North's economy. Nonetheless, the North has a major ally in China, and it has been able to evade all international sanctions, which have had no effect on its weapons programs. Just 3 days before today's inauguration, it tested a submarine-launched ballistic missile from a submarine which was damaged in its last SLBM test in October. So this was the first time in 7 months that it tested what has been called the world's most powerful weapon, because it can sneak up to the U.S. coastline and nuke the U.S. mainland. And experts say we'll be seeing these types of tests much more frequently now in the future, since they repaired their submarine. And 6 days before the inauguration, they fired off an intercontinental ballistic missile, which can carry a nuclear warhead to any point in the U.S. and also evade all U.S. missile defenses. So this is a real, real threat against South Korea. The ability to nuke the U.S. mainland, the South's nuclear umbrella provided by the U.S., will have no effect if that happens. And, of course, the U.S. and South Korea are beefing up their alliance. It's getting closer and closer, the two countries' relations, because North Korea, at a military parade last month, the leader, Kim Jong-un, he declared that not only is he going to keep nuclear weapons as a deterrent, but he's also going to proactively use them if his country's interests are threatened. So that means that the U.S. has to do something fast. And President Biden will be coming here for a summit with President Yoon Suk-yeol just 10 days from now, on May 21st. This is the quickest summit ever seen between the two countries after a South Korean presidential inauguration. And moreover, for the first time since President Lee Myung-bak, the U.S. will be coming here first for the summit. President Biden will go to Japan second. Under the previous administration of Moon Jae-in here, the U.S. appeared to be closer to Japan than South Korea, because the South Korea was pro-North Korea and favored engaging North Korea. But the current South Korean conservative president, the new one, he does not appear to be all that interested in engaging North Korea. He's only offering economic aid if North Korea denuclearizes. And the North has said it will never denuclearize and give up its most precious weapon that is essential for protecting itself.
Jennifer, how truthful do you think the North will find the newly inaugurated president of South Korea, given their sour relations and the dismal experience of their previous negotiations?
It's really dismal. The North does not trust South Korea at all, the new president, anymore, because the South Koreans, they elected this new president just by 0.73 percentage points. And this new president, he said that he is going to bring tactical U.S. nuclear weapons to South Korea. That's a threat against North Korea. He also said he would preemptively attack North Korea if he thought North Korea was going to attack first with, say, a hypersonic missile. Well, experts say, how is he going to know that North Korea is going to do a suicidal thing by shooting off a hypersonic missile at South Korea? Many experts say that is not fitting for a presidential candidate to say something like that. And furthermore, he said he would add THAAD batteries here. And China has in the past opposed THAAD batteries in South Korea, saying that they are designed to spy on China for the U.S. And they have levied economic sanctions on South Korea, many experts say, because of the previous THAAD battery installed there. But President Yoon wants to install more THAAD batteries. So he is going to have a tough time as president. He only won by 0.73%. He's having trouble getting his cabinet nominees approved by the opposition-led parliament, which was on the side of the previous president. The previous president opposed his moving the presidential residence and compound to the defense ministry. And most people here in South Korea oppose that move, but he's going to move there right after this inauguration. He has a lot of controversy surrounding him. He's not even able to reorganize his government and get rid of the Ministry of Gender Equality. There's a petition going on online with so many people opposing that getting rid of the gender equality ministry. This is for women's rights. And he says that women are to blame for the poor economy here in South Korea because they work instead of having kids. And he just does so many controversial things. He's going to have a tough battle ahead of him. We'll see how much he gets done.
Thank you so much. Jennifer Chang, our correspondent in the South Korean capital, Seoul. Moving on, Sri Lanka imposes a nationwide curfew after five people are killed in the latest wave of protests over an unprecedented economic crisis gripping the nation. The situation has been volatile in the country for weeks amid mostly peaceful protests, but violence flared Monday after supporters of Prime Minister Mahinda Rajapaksa were bussed into the capital, Colombo, and attacked protesters with sticks and clubs. Nearly 200 people were wounded in the violence. Rajapaksa later resigned, but even that failed to calm public anger. The military had to rescue him after protesters stormed his official residence overnight with police firing tear gas and warning shots to push back the crowd. Thousands of troops and police are now deployed in Colombo to enforce the curfew. The protests began several weeks ago over an economic crisis unseen in Sri Lanka since its independence in 1948. An initial vote count in Philippines presidential election shows the son of late dictator Ferdinand Marcos has won a landslide victory in the first win by a majority since 1986. With more than 93% of ballots counted, Marcos Jr. has garnered almost 30 million votes, surpassing the 27.5 million votes needed for a majority. According to the unofficial Commission on Elections tally, turnout stood at about 80%. Marcos Jr. delivered an address in the capital, Manila, after the early results were announced, but stopped short of claiming victory. The incumbent vice president, Liberal candidate Lenny Robredo, has come in second, gaining around 13 million votes. The election was held on Monday with 10 candidates competing for the top executive post. An official result is expected around the end of the month. The European Parliament has established a committee of inquiry into allegations that an Israeli software has been used by 50 nations to spy on at least 50,000 individuals. EU lawmakers are furious that the European Commission is refusing to set up its own investigation. Jerome Hughes reports from Brussels.
Israel has sold its Pegasus software to dozens of countries around the world, which allows spies to easily hack into mobile phones and retrieve personal data. Apparently, very high-profile individuals have been targeted. Now, the PEGA committee inside the European Parliament has been set up to investigate.
We cannot overemphasize the severity of this scandal. When this kind of spyware is used against innocent citizens, whether they're journalists, activists, lawyers, businessmen or politicians, then regardless where in the European Union or even beyond.
The European Commission has been slated for refusing to take action against Tel Aviv for failing to rein in Israel's NSO company, which produces Pegasus.
This is about the accountability of the European Commission to the European citizens and to the European Parliament. You have a duty to investigate.
EU Commissioner Johannes Hahn told lawmakers it's a matter for national governments.
Mr. Commissioner, if you say it's member states in charge, would you mind telling me which member state is actually in charge of investigating in this and protecting us?
EU countries Poland and Hungary have been heavily criticised for buying the spyware from Israel. But one lawmaker says the bloc turned a blind eye when it was revealed in 2019 that Germany was spying on its allies.
Do not be a hypocrite. Do not point Poland and Hungary, point everyone, because who was in charge of German government? Madam Merkel. You were shaking in front of Merkel. Everyone was silent.
There was even a commissioner saying, oh, haha, I have a very boring life. There's nothing on my phone.
Experts say the it's fine, I have nothing to hide argument doesn't hold water.
At the heart of liberalism is saying exactly the contrary. You always need to hide and to have an umbrella against the eye of the state.
The European Parliament's PEGA committee is due to conclude its inquiry in 11 months from now. Already there is a great deal of scepticism that the EU will take any action against Israel regardless of the findings. After all, it has always shied away from doing so in the past. Jerome Hughes, Brussels.
The Palestinian Health Ministry says Israeli forces have killed at least 50 Palestinians since the start of this year. The regime had killed 14 Palestinians in the same period last year. A ministry statement said all fatalities occurred in the occupied West Bank and East Al-Quds. The West Bank city of Jenin accounted for the highest toll with 17 fatalities, while Nablus saw 7 deaths. The list includes 2 women who were killed by Israeli forces last month, 2 13 and a 14-year-old teens, both from Bethlehem, where the youngest Palestinians killed so far this year. Tensions have been running high across the occupied territories in recent weeks. Israeli forces have launched a bloody crackdown across the West Bank amid a spate of deadly attacks in the occupied territories. Palestinians say their operations are in retaliation for Israeli aggression and occupation. Today marks the first anniversary of Israel's 11-day bloody bombardment of Gaza, which claimed the lives of more than 260 Palestinians and left the enclave in ruins. In this following report, we take a closer look at last year's devastating war on the besieged Palestinian territory.
Gaza left in ruins following 11 days of Israeli attacks on the besieged Palestinian territory. Palestinians breathed a sigh of relief from Israeli attacks after a ceasefire came into force on May the 21st. Cities and towns were heavily pounded by Israeli artillery and warplanes, even at night. Horror and panic go on. Some call their loved ones' names. Others rush them to hospital. And many more grieving for their loved ones. At the same hospital, 6-year-old Susie was reunited with her father. Susie was rescued after she had been trapped for 7 hours under the ruins of their home. Her mother and 4 siblings lost their lives. The Israeli attacks took a heavy toll on civilians and caused widespread devastation. But life goes on. Fears of a new outbreak of conflict is there too, as tensions simmer from time to time over Israel's continued occupation of Palestinian land.
The Secretary General of Lebanon's Hezbollah denounces calls for the resistance movement's disarmament. Sayed Hassan Nasrallah says the group's opponents want to turn the upcoming parliamentary election into a political war. Addressing a gathering in Beirut, Nasrallah rejected calls by some political actors for Hezbollah to be disarmed. He said those advocating disarmament want to sell the country to the U.S. and leave Lebanon exposed to Israel. The Hezbollah leader said those opposing the movement want Lebanon to forsake its most significant tool that can help the country drill national resources in its territorial waters. Nasrallah said resistance is ready to help the government extract offshore oil and gas resources, which can easily mitigate the ongoing economic crisis.
You have a resistance, a courageous resistance, a strong resistance, a capable resistance that can tell the enemy, which works day and night on drilling and removing all the natural resources in the disputed areas. We tell the enemy, if you prohibit Lebanon, then we'll prohibit you. Yes, we are capable of prohibiting the Israelis from drilling their natural resources. We have the courage, we have the strength, and we have the capabilities. And I assure you, and I guarantee this, not one single company would dare to come to Karish area or anywhere in the disputed area if Hezbollah declared a clear threat and a clear warning in this area.
Nasrallah stressed that those calling for disarming Hezbollah are ignorant of Israel's threat. He cited Israeli massacres in southern Lebanon, including a mass killing in the village of Hula in 1948. Nasrallah said the Lebanese people resorted to resistance, realizing that the government neglected its responsibility to protect them. He said the resistance secured southern Lebanon, brought self-confidence among the people, and defeated the so-called project of Greater Israel. Nasrallah urged people to vote for the resistance group in the upcoming elections, saying there is no hope for resolving Lebanon's problems without Hezbollah. That's your world news for now.
We are with you. What about you? IRIB English Radio. Log on to our website, www.parstoday.com/en.
Supplication on Tuesdays. In the name of Allah, the All-Merciful, the All-Compassionate. Praise belongs to Allah, and praise is His right, since Him deserves it, abundant praise. I seek refuge in Him from the evil of my soul, for surely the soul commands to evil, except as my Lord has mercy. I seek refuge in Him from the evil of Satan, who adds sins to my sin. I seek protection with Him from every wicked tyrant and unjust sovereign and conquering enemy. O Allah, place me among Thy troops are the victors, and place me in Thy party, for Thy party are the ones who prosper. And place me among Thy friends, for Thy friends no fear shall be upon them, nor shall they sorrow. O Allah, set right for me my religion, for it is the preserving tie of my affair. Set right for me my hereafter, for it is the abode of my permanent lodging, and to it I flee from the neighborhood of the vile. Make life an increase for me in every good, and death an ease for me from every evil. O Allah, bless Muhammad, the seal of the prophets, and the completion of the number of the envoys, and his household, the good, the pure, and his household, the good, the pure, and his companions, the distinguished. And give me on the Tuesday three things. Leave no sin for me unless Thou forgives it, and leave no grief unless Thou takes it away, and leave no enemy, and leave no enemy unless Thou repelst him. By means of in the name of Allah, the best of the names, in the name of Allah, Lord of earth and heaven, I seek to repulse every hateful thing, the first of which is His anger, and I seek to attract every lovable thing, the first of which is His good pleasure. So seal me with forgiveness from thee, O patron of beneficence.
The Limelight.
In New Mexico, the fastest warming and most water-stressed state in the continental U.S., where wildfires have recently devoured over 120,000 acres and remain uncontained, the oil and gas industry is coming out in force to deepen the region's dependence on fossil fuels. Please stay with us for an article in this regard, written by Lena First Arai, journalist. This article is published under the heading, How the Oil and Gas Industry is Trying to Hold U.S. Public Schools Hostage. Here's more. The U.S. oil and gas industry wants to play a word and picture association game. Think of four images: a brightly colored backpack stuffed with pencils, a smiling teacher with a tablet tucked under her arm, a pair of glasses resting on a stack of pastel notebooks, and a gleaming school bus welcoming a young student on board. What do all of these have in common? An April 6 Facebook post by the New Mexico Oil and Gas Association, MNOGA, asks, adding, they are powered by oil and natural gas. In New Mexico, the fastest warming and most water-stressed state in the continental U.S., where wildfires have recently devoured over 120,000 acres and remain uncontained, the oil and gas industry is coming out in force to deepen the region's dependence on fossil fuels. Their latest tactic to position oil and gas as a patron saint of education. Powerful interest groups have deployed a month-long campaign to depict the schools and children's well-being as under-threated government officials infringe upon fossil fuel production. In a video spot exemplary of this strategy, Ashley Neiman, a fourth grade teacher at Enchanted Hills Elementary School, tells viewers that the industry is what enables her to do her job. Without oil and gas, we would not have the resources to provide an exemplary education for our students, she says, adding, the partnership we have with the oil and gas industry makes me a better teacher. The video from September last year is part of a PR campaign by NMOGA called Safer and Stronger. It's one of many similar strategies The Guardian tracked across social media, television, and audio formats that employs a rhetorical strategy social scientists refer to as the fossil fuel savior frame. What NMOGA and the oil and gas industry are saying is that we hold New Mexico's public education system hostage to our profit-motivated interest, said Eric Schelker Goodrich, executive director of the Western Environmental Law Center, adding, there is an implied threat there. Last year, New Mexico brought in $1.1 billion from mineral leasing on federal lands, more than any other U.S. state. But the tides may be turning for the fossil fuel industry as officials grapple with the need to halve greenhouse gas emissions this decade. Before mid-April, the Biden administration had paused all new oil and gas leasing, and the number of drilling permits on public lands plummeted. In response, pro-industry groups are pushing out what some experts have called the sky-is-falling messaging that generates the impression that without oil and gas revenue, the state's education system is on chopping block. NMOGA did not respond for comment. Since February, NMOGA has flooded its social media pages with school-related motifs, like buses and books, but also with images of empty, abandoned classrooms accompanied by reminders about how the state's schools rely on oil and gas production on federal land for more than $700 million in funding. Elected officials have parroted this framing. This is a matter of critical importance to all, but especially to New Mexico's school children who have suffered greatly during the pandemic. State Representative Yvette Harrell co-wrote in the Santa Fe, New Mexico in February. But tax, budget, and public education funding experts say linking the federal leasing pause to a grave immediate risk to public education is deceptive. Any slight reductions stemming from pauses or other so-called adverse actions would have zero immediate effect on school funding overall, much less whether students get the services they need to recover from the ill effects on their learning from the pandemic, said Charles Goodmaker, former government and media relations director at the National Education Association, NEA, now a consultant. The sale of leases does not lead to immediate drilling, he said. Often companies sit on leases for months or years before production occurs. Industry attempts to convince New Mexicans that the state's public education system is wholly dependent on oil and gas are based on a tough truth. Decades of steep tax cuts have indeed positioned fossil fuels as the thunder behind Democratic-led New Mexico's economy. In 2021, 15% of the state's general fund came from royalties, rents, and other fees that the Department of the Interior collects from mineral extraction on federal land. Oil and gas activity across federal, state, and private lands contributes around a third of the state's general fund of $7.2 billion, as well as a third of its education budget. Some on the receiving end of oil and gas revenue stress that not all educators and students embrace fossil fuel industry money in public schools. Mary Bissell is an algebra teacher at Cleveland High School in Rio Rancho, who co-signed a letter in November, along with more than 200 educators asking NMOGA to stop using New Mexico's teachers and kids as excuses for more than oil and gas development. Bissell says in spite of how cash-strapped the schools may be, many of her colleagues don't want oil and gas money. I'm not going to teach any kids how to find the slop based on fracking, she said of her math courses. Bissell characterized NMOGA's attempt to portray educators as a unified force beholden to oil and gas funding as disgusting.
Fruitful Moments with IRIB English Radio. Log on to our website, www.parstoday.com
www.ukrainianpodcast.org/en.
Palestine Declassified.
Hello, I'm Chris Williamson, and welcome to the latest edition of Palestine Declassified, where we investigate the Israeli regime's global war against solidarity with the illegally occupied people of Palestine. A celebrity anti-Semitism campaigner was recently forced to admit that she'd made false allegations of anti-Semitism against a supporter of Palestinian rights. British actress Tracey Ann Oberon has issued an apology and paid undisclosed damages to her victim. To shield herself from criticism, Oberon pointed to her work with the charity Children of Peace, which works with young people in Gaza and the West Bank. But what is Children of Peace? In today's programme, we'll examine how a small British charity serves as a front group for Zionist interests. Later in the show, we'll look at the case of Tracey Ann Oberon and her involvement in smearing supporters of Palestinian rights and her association with pro-Israel lobby groups like Children of Peace. As always, I'll be speaking to experts on this issue to find out more. But first, we've got this special report by Bianca Rahimi.
Children of Peace. What could be more innocent an organisation set up to encourage young Israeli and Palestinian people to understand each other better? It operates directly in Gaza, the world's largest open-air prison, so one might think it was a critic of the Zionist entity. But when Palestine Declassified looked a little more closely, we discovered a strong Zionist bias in its activities. Children of Peace says it simply refuses to take sides on Palestine, a clear euphemism for siding with the oppressor, the occupying power. Among the trustees are Sarah Ans Brown, a former regular contributor to the Islamophobic attack blog Harry's Place. The charity receives pro bono legal advice from the law firm Taylor Wessing, which also participates on its advisory board. Taylor Wessing, which has a strong Israel group, is co-led by Nathan Krapovitsky, who is also a volunteer for the Australian Zionist group, the United Israel Appeal. Amongst its partners, the organisation lists the Abraham Fund Initiatives, an Israeli government-funded lobby entity, and One Voice, and its subsidiary Solutions, Not Sides, which is grooming schoolchildren to be pro-Israel. Both organisations have strong links with Israeli intelligence and the military. The charity recruits friends, amongst which are many Zionists, who do not struggle to take sides on Palestine. Rolene Marks, a participant in the Israeli Ministry of Foreign Affairs Young Jewish Diplomats Leadership course and a former representative to the World Zionist Congress. She is also co-founder of the South Africa Israel Policy Forum, an Israel lobby group. Dumisani Washington, who joined in March this year, is described by Children of Peace as one of the greatest advocates for Israel. He is a leading member of Christians United for Israel. Tracey Ann Oberon, the actress and campaigner against alleged anti-Semitism, also joined as a friend in March. Perhaps most concerning is the apparent role of covert lobby groups for the United Arab Emirates in the operation. Amongst the partners of the charity is the impressive-sounding Global Imams Council, which was welcomed as a partner in 2021. Based in Najaf, Iraq, this group has recently shown signs of penetration by the lobby of the United Arab Emirates. For example, the election of the so-called Imam of Peace, Mohammad Tawhidi, in early 2022. Tawhidi was also named by Children of Peace as a friend of the charity in March 2022. Tawhidi is well known to be an asset of the foreign policy establishment of the Emiratis and the go-to imam for elements of the UK far right, such as the Islamophobe Tommy Robinson. other UAE assets that support Children of Peace are Muslims Against Anti-Semitism. One of its leaders, Fiaz Mughal, is a friend of the charity. Children of Peace is a sophisticated subversion strategy involving a variety of lobby groups based in Iraq, occupied Palestine, the United Arab Emirates, and the UK.
As always, we're joined by our resident expert, David Miller. David's an academic and former professor at Bristol University and a leading British scholarly critic of Israel. He's also a co-founder and co-director of the lobbying watchdog initiative, Spinwatch. We're also joined by British political activist and writer, Jackie Walker. Jackie was born in Harlem in New York City. She's been a teacher and an anti-racist trainer. She's the co-writer and performer of a one-woman show, The Lynching, which documents how she became an early high-profile victim of the Labour Party's anti-Semitism witch hunt. And Jackie joins us from Ramsgate in Kent. Welcome to the show. David, I wanted to start with you. I mean, the Children of Peace sounds fairly harmless, doesn't it, really, on the face of it? I mean, how is it detrimental, do you think, to the Palestinian struggle?
Well, this is one of a whole range of organisations which we've looked at in many of the editions of this programme, which appears to be harmless, which appears to be encouraging nice things like peace and reconciliation and understanding, but which is our covert vehicles for Zionists. So it engages in projects in Gaza, in the West Bank, even in 48 Palestine, which try and get children to be friends with each other in order that they can stop discussing the really controversial issues about the fact of the occupation. And that's the purpose of this, is to divert attention from the occupation, to pretend that people who support Israel are interested in peace and reconciliation, and to give cover for those who it attracts to be their representatives.
Jackie, in your experience as an anti-racist trainer, I mean, do you think that this organisation is an effective way to combat structural racism?
No, I mean, obviously not. I mean, that's not how you do it. You actually have a balance, if you're going to have a balance, although I don't know what balance means in this circumstance, because we know the Israeli position as an occupying power and as an apartheid state. So I'm not quite sure what balance means in this point. So, I mean, I just think it's vacuous.
David, I mean, there was this UAA-backed initiative that was mentioned in the report. What's the significance of that?
Well, since the Arab Spring, the United Arab Emirates has become one of the foremost pushers of Islamophobia around the world, including in the UK, in the US, and in other countries too. And it's interesting that they are involved in this organisation seemingly too. They practice a kind of collaboration with Zionist lobbyists, and you can see that very much in the balance of friends and supporters that are here, that it's an attempt to push Islamophobic ideas and to push the idea that all we need in Israel and Palestine is a bit of understanding. We don't actually need justice. And that's the key message that they're pushing. But the UAE lobby has a number of different ways of expressing itself through groups in the UK, for example, which, and in the case of this film in Iraq, where it's not clear that these are UAE lobby groups, and one has to delve a little bit deep to find out. And that's what we did in this programme, to have a little look at that and to see the way in which UAE foreign policy interests are sort of filtered out through organisations like this.
Could you say us a little bit about this character, Imam Tawhidi? What's his story?
Well, Imam Tawhidi is a really very interesting character. Shia cleric. In his early interventions in the public sphere, he promoted a virulently anti-Sunni sectarianism, and then he kind of toned that down a little bit and realised that the gravy train that he wanted to get onto was the Western Islamophobic gravy train. So he now consorts with the far right and the Islamophobic network across the whole of the world, in Australia, in the UK, in the US. He hangs out with Tommy Robinson in the UK and Anne-Marie Waters, another far-right Islamophobe, and in the States with Spencer and with Daniel Pipes of the Islamophobic Middle East Forum. So he hangs out with those people. But he also is involved strongly with the United Arab Emirates so-called Peace Forum, which is part of a normalisation strategy to pretend that Zionism is something which could be a reasonable interlocutor for debate and discussion and moving towards peace, which, of course, It's not.
Mm. I mean, Jackie, there's all sorts of celebrities associated with this organisation, Children of Peace, that are also involved in the anti-Semitism witch hunt. I mean, you know, noted comedians like David Baddiel and Matt Lucas apparently are listed on their site. I mean, what's the role, do you think, of these celebrities in laundering the image of Israel?
Yeah, well, there's a number of them. I mean, most of them are pretty B, what we would call B players, really. You've got Eddie Marsden, you've got Rachel Riley. And what they do is that they sort of, they kind of wash, don't they? They give cover to these murderous organisations. And what's extraordinary about them, because they've got quite a wide reach, both because of who follows them and about and of their general TV exposure, is that people come to them and they think, these look like nice people, they're interesting people. They must be right about what they're saying. And if you, in particular, look at David Baddiel, who's just written this nonsensical book about discrimination, prejudice, racism against Jews, what never happens to these people is that they're never actually challenged. And it's not for want of trying. I know people who have tried to get on the British media to challenge their arguments. They never get on. And here we are, we're supposedly living in a free speech society.
Mm. I mean, Jackie, you know, we talked about these various celebrities, but also listed was the Palestinian envoy to the UK. I mean, what do you think that says about the Palestinian Authority?
Well, we understand the compromised position of the Palestinian Authority. And all of this, it all looks like one particular picture, doesn't it? Of being able to get these proxy players to kind of associate and authenticate what is a brutal and barbaric vestige of colonialism.
Yeah, I mean, and David, what if you could say something about the, you know, the Proudfoot case?
Well, I mean, one of the things about that is that Tracy Ann Oberman accused Philip Proudfoot of operating a Jew block list, i.e. blocking Jews on Twitter, which was, of course, a fabrication, entirely false, and she had to apologise for that. Mm. And what I think is most interesting about that is the way in which she subsequently used as a shield to defend herself her involvement with a number of pro-Israel organisations. Now, her general line is that she's just there to combat anti-Semitism, and she's not there as a Zionist, she's not there as a paid-up Israel lobbyist, but the organisations which she's used to defend herself, Solutions Not Sides, Children of Peace, are organisations which are deeply involved in Zionist advocacy. So what this case shows, inadvertently in relation to Tracy Ann Oberman, I think, is the way in which they are directly involved in pro-Israel and pro-Zionist advocacy. And of course, as we would have always suspected, the anti-Semitism activism in which they are engaged is part of that programme.
Yeah, yeah. And of course, you know, Philip Proudfoot is a founder of the Northern Independence Party. But, well, we'll just leave it there now, because we've got a report about Tracy Ann Oberman, who is an enthusiastic participant in the anti-Semitism witch hunt in the UK.
The actress and E-list celebrity Tracy Ann Oberman has spent many years on British television screens. From the trashy soap EastEnders to other nondescript roles in forgettable TV programmes, she's failed to make much of a mark in the acting world. Recently, she's taken to the road performing the controversial role of Shylock in the Shakespeare play Merchant of Venice. Some have claimed that the Shylock character perpetuates stereotypes, Judophobic stereotypes, but that doesn't seem to bother Oberman, who, like other E-listers, have made a name for themselves by falsely accusing others of anti-Semitism. The hypocritical wannabe Oberman has implied that almost everyone, from Amnesty International to Equity, the Union for Actors, Singers, Models and General Creatives, are motivated by anti-Semitism. The crime of her targets has always been connected to their support for the Palestinian cause. She has openly coordinated with Israel lobby groups like the Board of Deputies and groups with significant links to Israeli intelligence like the Community Security Trust. Here she is smearing the Actors Union Equity as racist for supporting a demonstration for Palestinian rights.
The problem that Jewish actors are having, and I think Maureen felt the same way, is that by dint of Equity's leadership statement, it's sort of turning into a political loyalty test for Jews in our industry.
But in a wonderful twist of fate, our insufferable protagonist and de facto leader got her comeuppance. On April 4, 2021, she falsely claimed that Palestinian rights activist Dr. Philip Proudfoot had a Jew block list on the Twitter website. This was, of course, completely false. Almost a year later, she's been forced to issue a public apology and reach a financial settlement with Dr. Proudfoot for her false claim of anti-Semitism. However, the incident has exposed connections between Oberman and organizations which have been revealed to have extensive links with Israeli intelligence. She has regularly advocated for the anti-BDS, behavioral change organization Solutions Not Sides, which targets Muslim children in British school. As a project of One Voice, Solutions Not Sides shared funders with the Friends of the IOF, illegal settler colonies in the West Bank, and the Conservative Party. Perhaps worse than that, the organization has had at least three employees simultaneously working for the Israeli government and at least 28 former Israeli occupation forces or intelligence service members working within it. This should place major question marks on our E-list celebrity and her activities in the public sphere.
Jackie, I wonder if I could come to you now. I mean, you've been involved in the arts and theatre now for many years. I just wonder what your take is on the entertainment industry.
Well, I think that my take on the entertainment industry is exactly my take on pretty much everything else. I mean, it's just a joke for Tracy Ann Overman to be complaining about the exposure that people like her get, because as far as I'm concerned, it's far too much, because they get an exposure without any challenge to their views. And, you know, this idea that they are being challenged, and, you know, all we've got to think of is what happens to pro-Palestinian people who work in the media. I mean, we recently saw two actresses who had terrible, terrible pylons on them for saying just basically, remember Palestine. I mean, this is extraordinary, but it shows the imbalance that's going on. And as long as we have this one-sided media, this is what we'll get. But the interesting thing about this, I think, is the media is actually failing to keep control of the narrative. Because if you talk to most people, they know it's untrue. So these people, they have sway with the elite, they have sway with the right, but most other people know exactly what's going on.
David, what do you think the significance is of Oberman advocating so strongly for Solutions Not Sides?
Well, it drives the coach and horses through the idea that there is any serious campaign against anti-Semitism in this country, which is divorced from a campaign for the State of Israel. And this Solutions Not Sides organization is, of course, part of another organization called One Voice, both of which are friends and associates of Children of Peace. And as the film showed there, I mean, they had people working within the organization who were at the same time working in Israeli intelligence or working in the Israeli embassy. Now, that's an extraordinary position to be in. And an organization like that should have no place in British political life. And yet someone like Oberman is advocating for it, which really reveals that the actual political agenda that is in operation here and is all of a piece with the activities of Children of Peace itself.
Mm. I mean, Jackie, what would you say to people who say, well, these celebrities are just concerned about race. It's not an issue about their sort of, you know, advocating for Israel. It's just a concern about racism. And how would you respond to that?
Well, I think all you have to do is do a bit of digging to see how untrue that is. There's a blog called Zelo Street, which actually has a list of the racism behind a number of these celebrities. So, for example, you have David Baddiel, who's well known in terms of having blacked up and made fun of a black football player to the point where I think this guy almost committed suicide and was being beaten up in the street. And he's never, as far as I've been told, directly said sorry to this person about it. I mean, what all of these celebrities share in common is a very strong sense of a hierarchy of racism that, interestingly enough, puts them on the top.
Yeah, I mean, and I know that you've been a target of abuse by some of these celebrities. I mean, tell us a little about the kind of human toll, the human cost of actually being a target like that by these high-profile individuals.
So there's all cool types of human cost, and I'm sure, David, and you know what I'm talking about, for goodness sake. It goes right from the fact that, you know, at one time I was, you know, well-published writer. I'll never get a book published again. I can hardly get a performance done anywhere. So there's that sort of the end of your political career. And that's just what it means, the end of your artistic career. That is what it means if you speak out. But there's also, you know, the personal cost, because I'm Jewish. I'm married to somebody who's Jewish. His family live in Israel, Palestine, and the fallout on that for our family has been extraordinary. And there were times when I was getting threats. I was going to be burnt. I was going to be raped. I was going to be hung outside my door. My children were going to be abused in the same way. And I was receiving those kind of threats repeatedly. Interestingly, the media or the Labour Party were not at all interested in the level of threats that I was getting. And I'm sure that's a familiar story for many people in my position.
David, I mean, what's the relationship between this Solutions Not Sides and One Voice?
Well, Solutions Not Sides is an organisation which the Education Secretary, last year when the attack on Gaza was happening, wrote to all head teachers and said, you mustn't be having unbalanced narratives about Israel-Palestine in the classroom. You must instead have three organisations who give balanced narratives, and Solutions Not Sides was one of those organisations. And as it turns out, Solutions Not Sides is not really an independent organisation. It's part of another organisation called One Voice, which is itself closely connected to the Israeli intelligence apparatus, but also to the Israeli military. Something like 20 or 30 former members of staff, certain members of staff there have formerly been in the Israel Defense Forces, including in special forces. And so there's a very strong connection between Solutions Not Sides and One Voice, and that they themselves have a strong connection with the Israeli establishment. So there's a real issue here, which is that the British government is promoting effectively Zionist propaganda in British schools as an antidote to Muslims feeling solidarity with Palestine. And that kind of thing should just be stopped.
Mm. I mean, Jackie, you know, you've spoken about, you know, the abuse and the toll that it's taken on you and indeed, you know, others. But I remember, I mean, it took an even more sinister turn, didn't it, a couple of 3 years ago when there was going to be a screening. I mean, I was up in, I think it was in Liverpool, actually, for the Labour Party conference. There's going to be a screening of the film Witch Hunt, which documents in large detail the travails that you've been subjected to. I mean, obviously that was a very kind of worrying threat. I wonder if you could just sort of say whether you feel that the role of these celebrities have actually, you know, put you in danger effectively.
Well, I just want to say something about what happened there, because it was extraordinary, because this screening was actually sponsored by a Jewish group. So there were lots of Jews there. And somebody phoned up and said something like, there's a bomb there, we're going to kill a lot of Jews. There were police cars and everything. Everybody had to leave the theatre. There was not one national report of that happening during the Labour Party conference, not one. There was a local paper report, and that tells you a lot of what actually is happening in terms of this. So what we do with that, we just go on, don't we? We just continue to write and speak and fight against it, just like you do, Chris, and just like David does.
Well, that's what we have to do. We have to stand tall and keep going. Thank you very much indeed, Jackie, for joining us. And thank you for your courage. I'm afraid we're going to have to leave it there because we've unfortunately run out of time. But thanks indeed for joining us. We'll be back next week with more news and analysis on Palestine Declassified. So until next time, this is Chris Williamson saying bye for now.
In the limelight. Even the wealthiest enclaves of the British capital turned against the Tories recently. But what has made the City of London a Labour redoubt? And is its dominance more of a menace than a boon? We now present you an article written by Andrew Anthony. The piece is titled UK Local Elections, How London Turned from Blue to Red. The most expensive property on the Monopoly board is Mayfair, which also happens to be the most exclusive expanse of real estate in real-life London. Flush with private equity firms, eye-wateringly expensive restaurants and luxury car showrooms, it voted Labour in recent local elections and helped swing Westminster Council away from the Tories for the first time. Recent years have seen working-class strongholds in the north of England turning Tory, and now you have the even odder spectacle of the super-rich in London voting Labour. That says something about Labour's success in the capital, but it also suggests that there is a growing divide between London